Namo tassa bhagavato Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Homage to the blessed, noble, and perfectly enlightened one. Andamayam Buddha Bhitutin Karuma Sahe.
Dhammang Sirasana Mami.
I chant my praise to this teaching. I bow my head to this truth. Namayang Sankha Bitu Tinkaroma Se. Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sankho. They are the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well. Uju Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sankho. Who have practiced directly. Nyaya Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sankho. Who have practiced insightfully. Samichi Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sankho. Those who practice with integrity. Yadi dang chatari purisa yugani yata purisa pugala. That is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble being. Is a bhagavato savaka sankho. These are the Blessed One's disciples. Ahuneyo, such ones are worthy of gifts. Bahuneyo, worthy of hospitality. Dakineyo, worthy of offerings. Anjalikaraniyo, worthy of respect. Anuttaram punya ketam lokasa. They give occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world. Tamaham sankham abhipujayami. Tamaham sankham sirasanamami. I chant my praise to this Sangha. I bow my head to this Sangha.
We'll have a short sitting first, and then I'll give the Dhamma talk, and then we'll have another short sitting program.
Thank you. So we've had a day of practice together, a day of walking, sitting, contemplating the teachings of the Buddha. And we can notice the result of that, like comparing how you feel now with, say, how you felt this time yesterday. We were just beginning the retreat. A very different feeling in the room. Really a sense of people having made considerable effort to stay present, to come for things and to participate. The walking and the sitting. I must say I find that very, very encouraging. To have a sense of everyone participating, everyone doing this together. And also to see the benefit, good results from having spent time like this. Good results in terms of the mind being a little bit more settled, perhaps a little bit more sense of ease and inner well-being, perhaps a sense of having in some way been able to leave behind the regular concerns of one's daily life. The things that one has to attend to, one has to be responsible for. Like a holiday or a holy day, a chance to do what is perhaps even more important than our regular duties and responsibilities. A chance to really care for our own hearts and minds and bodies. Make that the priority for this couple of days. I must say I was really, really looking forward to the retreat because it might surprise you to know that monastic life can be incredibly busy and one can have many, many responsibilities and there's something very relaxing about just sitting with 40 or so other people, just focusing on Dhamma practice, rather than having to sort out this and worry about that and telephone this person and send this fax here and receive these emails and respond to these emails and the busy life we lead. So it's very nice to have this chance to do some meditation together. Not that the other things need to be a hindrance to our practice. And in fact, one of the things that I find most exciting about the Buddhist teaching is the fact that it is about developing a sense of inner poise. No matter what might be happening within or around. So we can see this time together is like a chance to just really get a taste for that inner balance, perhaps, and get some sense of how we tend to complicate our lives, how we tend to create enormous amounts of stress and suffering for ourselves unnecessarily. And I find that very encouraging because, you know, most of us, most of the time, do have to relate with other people. We do have to live in the world, in the world that is many problems in the world. And so that the possibility of being able to maintain some kind of inner poise and able to provide tools or skillful means for others, you know, directly through teaching like this or just through one's example, feels like a very, very positive contribution that one can make on this planet at this time. You know, even if we don't feel that our meditation practice is all that great, we sometimes nod off or a very busy, frantic mind. Even if we're not terribly diligent or terribly regular about our practice, even just the little bit that we do can have a positive effect on those that we live with, those around us in the society. And it's very nice to feel that one can do something. You know, you hear about these ghastly things happening in different parts of the world and terrible deprivation even in this country. And the sense that, well, perhaps my life, my efforts towards understanding can in some way bring a little bit more light into this troubled human realm. Obviously, there are occasionally opportunities to spend time alone, to live in some remote place and be a hermit and really perhaps go a little bit deeper in one's practice, untangle a few of the more deeply buried knots, and perhaps experience greater degrees of calm. But the Buddha's teaching, one of the verses that I particularly like in a sutta on the greatest blessings, says that something like, though living in the world, yet one's heart is unshaken, unshakable, free from sorrow, confusion, need. A sense of actually, sense of fullness and well-being, a sense of completeness, in that we have everything that we need to live with this sense of ease and calm, even when conditions around us are very confusing, very difficult. So this is like a training ground or a place where we explore ways of cultivating this inner ease and well-being. I like the idea of cultivation because it's similar to like cultivating the soil, cultivating plants. And the idea of actually just planting the seed and then providing the best possible conditions to enable them to grow. Just watching these little tiny leaves appearing and gradually watching them growing bigger, and then, you know, sooner or later there's a flower and a fruit. And it's like this with our own practice. We don't get the fruit straight away. It'd be nice if we did. But it requires application. Really contemplating what is the right kind of nourishment, what are the right conditions for the plant to grow. You know, the seed has been planted. The fact that each one of us is here implies that there is an understanding that this way of practice is something that can bring bring good results, that can bring benefit. You know, the fact that you've all applied yourselves, that we've all kind of made effort today, that we've sat through periods of of time, you know, when perhaps it wasn't always particularly pleasant, but we've stayed with it. The fact that we've done the walking meditation, you know, walked up and down for considerable length of time, making the effort to be present. You know, there must be something in there that feels that it's worth doing. So there is a seed. There is a seed and the chance now to experience how that seed does, given these conditions. The Buddha taught that we have everything that we need within this body and mind for perfect liberation. That we don't have to go out and buy expensive equipment to free the heart. We don't have to travel to faraway places. That all we need is the body, the mind, and to have some for the teachings to be presented. We have the ability to contemplate our lives, and this Dhamma teaching is like a pointing, showing us how to use the mind and body, how to work with the conditions that we experience in our lives. So, as I've said earlier on today, you know, a lot of the teaching is completely obvious when we think about it. Yeah. Of course everything's impermanent. Of course it's not terribly satisfactory because of that very fact. You know, we can't rely on the kind of pleasant experiences we have in the ordinary way of human existence. We can't rely on our own bodies to permanently make us feel happy and contented and at ease, you know, because they're impermanent. They're always changing. You know, having been born, they've grown up, and the aging process is quite well advanced for some of us. And in due course, the body will die. It's not a lasting, permanent condition that we can rely on to make us feel good, that can make us feel happy. You know, we'll have moments of well-being and ease, hopefully. You know, it's not continuously painful and miserable, but there will be moments of contentment and bodily well-being. But it's not a permanent condition. It's continuously changing. You know, we feed it, we have delicious meal and feel very good. If we overeat, then we feel bad from overeating. But if we've eaten just the right amount, we feel really good. It feels quite pleasant feeling of fullness in the belly. But then, in due course, we get hungry again. Yeah, so we have to feed it again. It goes on and on, feeding it, offering it something to drink, just nurturing the body, caring for the body. And with the mind, we might sometimes experience a feeling of ease and well-being, perfect moment, perhaps in our daily lives, in some relationship, or experiencing something very, very pleasant, or perhaps in our meditation. Yes. I suspect for each one of you today there was probably a moment or two where it was just very, very pleasant, very happy, calm, peaceful, feeling of being collected and at ease. And the bell rings and we have to get up and do something else and all of our bliss disappears. We want it back again. That kind of suffering, that kind of struggle. So, we recognize the limitations this human existence. As I said, it's obvious when it's, you know, when we think about it, but we actually need to experience it firsthand. We need to actually give ourselves the chance to contemplate very directly these teachings, to apply them. And so this is what we've been doing today. We're just really studying our existence, studying our life in a very direct way. And it's easy to hear the teachings, it's easy to learn them off by heart, and then to kind of live our lives, you know, fill our lives up with busyness, you know, getting up, cleaning our teeth, having breakfast, going to work, coming home, crashing out in front of the telly, eating, drinking, chatting with one another. Just busy, busy, busy all the time. We feel a bit kind of miserable. We have a hamburger or an ice cream, or put on a piece of music that we like, or telephone a friend, or go and buy ourselves a little something to cheer ourselves up. There are endless ways that we can actually distract ourselves. But during this couple of days, we have a chance to really, really study, really observe, you know, what it means to be a human being, what it actually involves. Not with a view to making ourselves miserable, but with a view to finding a deeper kind of happiness, a deeper kind of well-being that is not dependent on everything being tickety-boo, everything being all right around us and within. I've talked about the first two characteristics of existence that the Buddha recommended that we contemplate. There's a passage in the morning chanting, not the chanting that we've been doing so far, but later on passage in the chanting that we do in the monastery quite regularly, where it talks about the suffering that comes from attachment to what we call the five khandhas, the five focuses of the grasping mind, or the five focuses of identity. So the physical body, and then the aspects of mind, there's a feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. And it said that the Buddha encouraged his disciples frequently to reflect on the fact that these conditions are all impermanent, subject to suffering, they're unsatisfactory. And then the third characteristic, that they're not self. They're not what we are, essentially. And that until we really understand this, through this contemplation, such as we've been doing today, we'll always be subject to suffering. They'll always lead us to stress, to dis-ease. We won't actually really experience that sense of ease and well-being that is our birthright, in some sense. And this is something that does take a little bit of contemplation. Because until the penny drops, these things do seem very much like me. You know, it's quite natural for us to identify with the body. You know, unless we really question that identification, we tend to just automatically think, well, this is me. You know, and if someone hits us, we feel pain, and you know, that's me, I'm hurting. How dare they hit me? How dare they assault me? It's quite interesting to notice, like, our sort of cultural conditioning. Like in Thailand, it's considered to be very, very bad manners to touch somebody else on the head. I mean, you can do it with little children, that's all right. But if you touch a monk or nun on the head, I mean, it's very, very shocking. Just not done. Considered very, very disrespectful. So one could be quite offended if somebody, you know, touches you on the head. But that's a cultural conditioning. You know, when we actually reflect on the body as to whether it's me and mine, you can begin to think, well, you know, am I? You know, is this body me? And if so, which bit of it? Or is all of it me? You know, what happens when I cut my fingernails? What happens when I shave my head? Am I in some way diminished because of having shaved off some hair or shaved off, you know, cut my fingernails? Or what if I lose a finger? You know, lots of people lose bits of themselves through unfortunate circumstances. And I mean, I notice myself, it can be quite shocking when I hear about somebody who maybe has an amputation. It's very shocking because of the extent to which we tend to identify with the physical form. But if we really contemplate our bodies, we begin to see that actually they're just part of nature. That we don't need to identify with them in this way. If we really contemplate, we see, well, actually, this isn't really what I am, essentially. You know, it's a very, very remarkable organism. It's something that I obviously have a very close association with. You know, having been born, grown up, experience sickness, disease, there's the awareness that it's going to die. So we can take an interest in it, we can take care of it, we can have a sense of respect and appreciation for this body, because, you know, through this body we can, this is how we experience the world in some sense. You know, what we see, what we hear, the fragrance, what we smell, taste, touch. And these are all the senses that are part of the body that enable us to have an awareness of our surroundings. But the Buddha encouraged us to really challenge and to question that identification with it. You know, when we contemplate our existence in this way, you know, although physical pain and disease are not particularly pleasant experiences, we can nonetheless find a sense of ease, a sense of calm, even when things are going very, very wrong with the body. You know, because we know that it's just part of nature. We know that it's not who and what we are, essentially. We can begin to live more peacefully with it. In this society, there's so much importance put on, you know, how we appear, what we look like. And we can suffer enormously because of things not being quite right about our bodies. noticing the first grey hairs appearing, or little kind of wrinkles that don't actually go away. Things beginning to sag and droop a bit. Not having so much flexibility. Aches and pains, sort of signs of aging. It can be a very very demoralizing business if we don't actually contemplate, you know, is this body actually who and what I am, or is it just part of nature? A good friend, something to take care of, something to respect. I remember reading Gone with the Wind years ago, and these stories about these young women who'd put on these corsets, and they'd sort of pull them tighter and tighter and tighter, so they'd have 18-inch waists or 16-inch waists, and sort of tiny, tiny little waists, because that was considered to be a sign of beauty. And terrible, it's like some kind of medieval torture. So I'm not saying that we need to totally disregard our bodies, sort of try to override or ignore the physical needs that we may have, but to see that they are part of nature, they are changing. Sooner or later they're going to totally let us down by dying on us. And for most of us they'll get old and they'll get sick. So not to put too much importance on staying young and beautiful or handsome forever. You know, we can enjoy physical beauty, our own or others, but it's not something to place too much importance on. Just learning how to live with the body in a way that is not too painful, too miserable. You know, if we have the good fortune to have enough food, shelter, clothing to protect the body, we can consider ourselves very fortunate, and it's fine to do these things, it's fine to take care of it, but not to see it as me or mine. And this sense of self is a very perplexing issue for many people. And it's perhaps the question I'm asked most frequently after, second most frequently, the most frequent one is, why do you shave your head? Actually, no, the second one is, what did your parents say when you became a nun? And thirdly is just, you know, this not self question, you know, what do you mean by anatta? How, you know, what does that mean? How can I relate to this fact or concept? And perhaps that's the key, this word concept. If we can see the sense of self as being a concept rather than a reality, it's something that we create, a sense of self, a sense of personality. And it's a concept, it's a sort of a process of conditioning that happens throughout our lives. You know, we're taught to be a self, we're taught to be a somebody, a personality. And the personality consists of, you know, our Obviously, the body is part of it, the way that we present ourselves, whether we're attractive or unattractive. But also, the personality, the sense of self, is very much bound up with other qualities, besides the physical qualities, like our sort of things like nationality, the way that we speak, the way that we dress, the way that we express ourselves, the kind of things that we do, the way that we entertain ourselves, how we spend our free time, our profession, our career, things that we're good at, things that we're lousy at, kind of jokes that we like, where we come in the family. These kind of things, they all kind of contribute to how we view ourselves. Whether we're the oldest or the youngest or somewhere in the middle. Yeah. And it's all also bound up with how we've been related to. How people have treated us. The sort of area of exploration I got quite interested in is just the whole idea of how we're received when we're born. That apparently, and I haven't actually experienced, I haven't sort of done any kind of regression therapy, but apparently they say that, the way that we're actually greeted when we're first born has a very, it's like imprints itself, and that we tend to view ourselves through that conditioning. So, people who perhaps were born in unfortunate circumstances, maybe they weren't particularly wanted as babies, maybe the parents were very worried about them. They can always have they grow up with a sense of actually maybe they're not, it's not all right for them to be here. Or, I was quite lucky because I asked my mother, I said, about my birth, I said, well, were you pleased? Was I welcome? I was the oldest, the first child. And she said, oh yes, you were very, very much appreciated. And whereas I was like the first granddaughter, like my grandparents, they all died actually. I only had one grandmother who was around for 2 months. I never met her after I was born, but, my mother's brothers and sisters, they kept producing sons. So there were about 6 grandsons. And I was the first granddaughter. So they were very, very chuffed. Very pleased. And it's interesting because, I've always assumed that it was all right for me to be around. And, which was quite useful because in this, like, monastic community, I was one of the first nuns. And whereas, Some women who come to the community because the nuns are always kind of second, and well, there weren't any nuns to start with, and so there was always a feeling of, maybe we weren't welcome, maybe it wasn't really all right for us to be around. I've always assumed, of course, it was fine. Of course, I belong, no doubt, and that's been quite useful to have that sense of belonging and that it was all right as a woman to be part of this whole thing. But it's very much a conditioned thing, like how I view myself is very much a conditioned thing, and similarly for each one of you, it's part of our conditioning. We have these things that have been conditioned and into us, from a very early age. Whether you're intelligent, what your IQ is. In this culture, having a high IQ is considered to be very good, being able to solve problems, being able to make conversation, being able to, having skills, abilities. They're all things that sort of add up to this personality. And, this is like the sense of self that is created. Sort of sticking things together to make a me. And we can suffer enormously about this me. Whether it's good enough. whether it's in comparing it with others, you know, whether this me is as good as that me. Yeah. It was a very competitive society. And so there's all these kind of values that we kind of measure ourselves against. And incredible suffering that can come from that. And we bring it into the meditation hall. You know, who's the best meditator? Who can sit for the longest? Or there's a feeling, I used to always have the feeling that I was just lousy meditator, hopeless case. And I'd hear people talking about their practice and they'd talk about their different experiences and I would get more and more miserable and wretched because I didn't have those experiences. And, it's interesting that the Buddha, discourse is in a collection of teachings called the Sutta Nipata, and little verses that repeat themselves many times. It's a collection of teachings that I very much like, and these verses are saying that, you know, if you think that you're, if you compare yourself to someone else, and if you think you're better than they are, he said that's wrong view. If you think you're worse than somebody else, but that's wrong view too. If you think you're the same as somebody else, that's wrong view too. What he was pointing to is any sense of self and other is wrong view. So where does that leave us? And there's no doubt that we do have a sense of self. There's no doubt that there is this personality thing that we've created and that other people create. So it's not, it doesn't just go one way. It's not just that I create myself, but other people create me as well. It's quite amusing how other people create you, like, you know, people who've known, you know, who've known one very well for a long time. You know, like one's parents. Very often they can kind of think of one as still as you were as a little girl or a little boy. This can happen with parents and children, and you know, even when you're 50 or 60, you still want mummy to be there to make everything all right. Sort of, we kind of want to fix each other into these kind of comfortable roles. And we tend to relate to one another through a veil of personality. You know, all of the, like the anticipation. You know, if we, when I was talking about this meeting I had to go to, you know, I'd created these people I was going to have to go and relate to. These personalities. And I'd created myself and I'd created the whole scenario. And as we all know, when we anticipate something, of course it turns out completely differently. So, this sense of self is something that really needs to be understood. You know, there's no doubt that there is something, but it's a creation of the mind. And so the Buddha's encouragement to us was to continuously challenge the assumptions that we make about who and what we are. And in some sense, this is perhaps the essence of the practice. To keep dismantling that fixed, solid sense of a personality, rather than to believe in it unquestioningly. One of the ways I find that a kind of a way into this contemplation is perhaps through noticing how our view of ourselves changes. So you can notice how you think of yourself on a good day or at a good time of the day. Notice how you feel about yourself, how you would describe yourself in your better moments. I'm really not too bad, actually. Quite good. You can think of all the positive things that we've done, all the good things that we've done, and we can kind of create quite a positive, happy sort of self. You know, being quite all right. You know, I deserve my place on this planet. Yeah, I'm okay. You know, hopefully each one of us has moments when we feel, you know, quite okay. And then the times when we've done something really stupid. We've made some horrible mistake. Or times that we just feel not so good. Notice a sense of self that is created at that time. And when we're depressed, when we're low, it's very difficult to imagine ever feeling otherwise. It's very, very, very real, the sense of self, the hopeless failure sense of self. But the positive sense of self is just as real as the negative sense of self, or rather just as unreal. Just as much of an illusion. When we're fully present, when we're perfectly present, in the moment, you know, when you're on your walking path with the footsteps, when you're in the meditation hall with the breath, when you're not thinking about who and what you are, the personality in some sense dissolves. It's just not there. Neither our own personality nor anybody else's. Letting go of the sense of self. In fact, in our daily lives, we're not always a self. And that's quite interesting to notice. You know, when you're just, I don't know, doing something that you enjoy, pottering about, there isn't a self there. But if you're pottering about and somebody comes along and either admires what you're doing or criticizes it, then you can notice a sense of self arise. Comes up very quickly. Me in relation to them. The sense of self tends to exist in relation to another self. And that's where all the problems arise. Me and them, us and them. The most terrible, terrible problems arise because of this identity with some aspect of self. Yeah. If we identify with our religious bias, if we identify with our nationality, if we identify with our family, we identify with the sexual nature of our body. And if that's what we make our identity, then there's always going to be other. And sometimes it's okay if we're in concord, if we're in harmony with the other. But we're not always going to be in harmony. We're not always going to be in concord with the other. And the most terrible things can be done. In the name of religion, in the name of nationality, and so on. You know, if there's somebody that's other, you know, we can really do awful things. Us and them. So the Buddha, he encouraged us just to contemplate our common humanity. You know, all of us are subject to aging, we're subject to sickness, we're subject to death. And that's something that we all share, no matter what colour, what race, what sex, no matter what religious path, no matter what political persuasion we might be, if we have a political persuasion, no matter how intelligent we are, how foolish we are, no matter what our physical ability or disability, these are things that we all share. So in understanding, in coming to an appreciation of this sense of self, perhaps the most useful thing is just to notice when it's present. Notice it as it arises. This is not always going to be particularly pleasant, because often, as I said, it arises when there's another self that we, and it's often to do with conflict. You know, somebody disagrees with us. Somebody wants to do things differently. Monastic life is wonderful for studying this, because, you know, just somebody chants too fast, or too slow, or too loud. We can get very upset with them. Or the way that somebody sits, the way that somebody moves, the way that somebody looks at us. You know, who do they think they are? Well, that's a sense of self. This is not in any way to dismiss religious conventions. It's not in any way to dismiss national identity. These things are all valid as conventional realities. But we need to really understand how it works in relation to ultimate truth, ultimate reality. You know, these are just identities. They're not really who and what we are essentially. What I am essentially is other than my body, than my mind, than the fact that I'm was born in a certain country, that my parents are so-and-so, that I come in this place in the family, that I'm good at this, that I'm bad at that, that I have these friends, that I practice according to the Buddhist teachings. These are all labels that we can add on, but they're not what I am essentially. And it's the same for each one of you. You're not what you think you are. That when you're perfectly present, there is an identity that is totally other than any of the labels that you give yourselves. And this way of practice is about uncovering that. It's about being. Just being fully what we are. Through questioning, through challenging the assumptions, the labels that we tend to plaster onto ourselves. So in the morning chanting, form is not self. So the physical form is not self. Feelings are not self. Perception is not self. Memory is not self. Our cultural identity is not self. All of the things that we think we can do, that we think we're good at, all the thoughts that we have about ourselves are not self. Consciousness is not self. These are all aspects of mind, aspects of body, but they're not actually what we are essentially. We can be aware of these things. There is that which is aware of these things. And it's that that is unshaken. So, though living in the world of conditions, living with a body, living with a mind, that experiences all kinds of things. it is possible to cultivate that quality of awareness that is unshaken, that sense of refuge that can never be damaged, never be hurt, never be harmed. So, you know, when we contemplate in this way, then even when even when we're seriously ill, even at the point of death, gives us that quality of presence, that quality of awareness, alertness, attentiveness to just how it is right now. There is that which just knows that this is just conditions changing. We're no longer grasping onto an identity. We're no longer fearful of the fact that things are changing. And obviously the moment of death, it's a very dramatic change. The body dies. The future is completely unknown. But it needn't be a source of trembling, a source of fearfulness. When we find that refuge, when we really cultivate that refuge, the more than we can, the moment of death will come to each of us once. But obviously throughout our lives, there are times that we're challenged. Like the question about, how do you practice when you have a very busy life? When you're constantly having to interact with people, constantly having to meet different challenges, constantly having your buttons pressed, constantly being upset. Sometimes it's just like, so you're just being constantly sort of surrounded by things that are sort of jangling and jarring. And I don't know about you, but sometimes it just feels as though that your skin is just not there. You're completely raw and sensitive, and everything is upsetting. And there are days that are like that. But when we take refuge in the Buddha, that quality of awareness, when we're fully present, we can simply recognize, okay, this is unpleasant feeling. When there's perfect mindfulness, and I'm not saying that we're all of us going to manage this perfect mindfulness all the time, but if we can have a moment of perfect mindfulness, we see that we have the possibility of not reacting through aversion, through desire. We begin to see that the real suffering of existence is actually not the painful, jarring, difficult things that we have to experience. It's not the being challenged. But it's the reaction. It's the demand that things be otherwise. It's the struggle with the painful, difficult conditions. That's the suffering. And that's the suffering that we have the potential of liberating ourselves from. We'll never stop the body from getting painful. We'll never stop the kind of unpleasant sensory impingement that we all have to experience at different times. But we do have the possibility of relinquishing the struggle for things to be other than the way that they are. So today we've been cultivating the conditions within which we can contemplate these teachings. When we're in the middle of a very, very busy, hectic lifestyle, it is more difficult to be aware of change. It is more difficult to really actually challenge our identities. It is more difficult to contemplate our suffering. And so, to have a chance to come and spend some time in retreat where we can let the mind settle down just a little bit, where we can be in reasonably peaceful surroundings, where we're not always kind of having things kind of coming at us and agitating us, stirring us up. The mind can settle a little bit and we can begin to have a sense of what these teachings are about. And having had a chance to contemplate the teachings in this way, we can then begin to have a little bit more of a perspective on the things that happen to us in our daily lives. We can begin to experience, perhaps just occasionally, from time to time, perhaps just very fleetingly, moments where everything around us is jarring and jangling and difficult and pressing, or really stirring us up. And we can, perhaps in the midst of that, just find moments when, okay, we just know, okay, this is how it is right now. This is unpleasant. I would rather it was otherwise, but it's all right. I can bear with it. I can be with this moment. I can be with this moment without adding to it, without struggling with it, and I can just allow things to change quite naturally on their own. And this is a tremendous gift, because just one person in a very busy, frantic situation, just one person who has this perspective can infect everybody else with this calm. And it's quite a tall order, I know, because what tends to happen is that we get overwhelmed by the things coming at us. But if we can, even just for a second, maintain a sense of inner poise, inner balance, equanimity, then there's a possibility of others picking up on this. Obviously, it requires a continuous application. It requires living our lives in a way that supports mindfulness. Using the precepts, living carefully, living skillfully, living responsibly, so that it's cultivating a sense of inner ease, well-being, cultivating a sense of self-respect, that we can actually stand up with a feeling of knowing that we're okay. You know, knowing that we're doing the best we can in our lives, in our practice. This is a tremendous resource. So I'm aware that I could carry on talking about these things for many hours. Something that interests me greatly, but I'm also aware that we've had a long day and that everyone has, you know, put a lot of effort into practice today, and you're probably quite tired. So I'd like to end these reflections, and I offer them for your contemplation. If any of it seems perplexing or nonsensical, perhaps just think about it a little bit, and if it's still perplexing and nonsensical, you're welcome to dismiss it. But anything that does make sense, please make use of it. And may it bring you to ultimate perfect freedom from every bit of suffering in your life. Ewan. So, I suggest you stand up for a couple of minutes. If anyone needs to pop out briefly, that's fine. But at least stand up, have a bit of a stretch, and we'll just end with a short sitting.